But we have two sessions in which we're going to try to do what I really wish were in four sessions, but anyway, we'll crowd it in. I'll probably talk twice as fast. But to again carry on with seeing if we can have an overview of Anthropogenesis, Volume 2, I want today to get into these three further postulates which HPB gives us. But I am suggesting that really the entire key to this second set of stanzas, which comprise Volume 2 and deal therefore with Anthropogenesis, is found in the question that is asked, two questions really, but one question basically, in Shloka 16. Now you'll remember I said last time that while the stanzas are divided in this second series, and we have in effect what she says are fragments from 12 stanzas, she numbers the shlokas consecutively through them. So in a sense, we don't have to worry about what stanza it is, do you see? It's really 49 shlokas that are given to us. So it's enough to give the shloka, because that immediately identifies where it is. And I think, in effect, you can forget the stanza number in this second set. You can't in the first volume, of course, because there the shlokas are numbered only within the stanzas. But here, the numbering of the shlokas is consecutive. And this is shloka 16 out of the 49. And I think it sets the keynote, because this is the essence that we're coming to. This is, as we will see next week, certainly, when we come to the third of the postulates, we will see that the whole focus is indeed anthropogenesis, which is the genesis of anthropos, or man. That is the archetype which is known as man. So the question is, how are the manushya born? The manus with minds, how are they made? This is the whole subject. How did we get here? We with minds, with the power of manas, awakened. The manushya are, of course, the beings with minds. And so it's the answer to this question that really is the center point of all our studies. And it is indeed the reason for, if I can put it this way, the whole raison d'etre of Volume 1 of Cosmogenesis, to give us the pattern by which the manus with minds, the manushya, man as the archetype, arises. How did we come to be, and whence came the mind that inquires into our very existence? The mind that is able to say, how did I get here? What am I doing? Where am I going? Now, in a previous series, as some of you will remember, who were with me through some of these series of classes, I referred to the work of Dr. Herbert Günther, who is, of course, one of the great Tibetan scholars of our time. He is a professor at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada and is probably the leading authority on Tibetan texts. And I referred to the work which is just came out last year, which he translated, a marvelous Tibetan text in one of the great schools of Tibetan Buddhism. And he translated it under the title The Matrix of Mystery, you remember. And of course, the whole matrix of mystery is man, is the human stage. And that work, I think, is really quite relevant to our present studies, because we have to keep in mind that the true mystery of being, and it's a mystery in the sense, in the original Greek sense of muo, to seal the lips, because it is not that which can be spoken so much as that which is. which exhibits itself, in other words, is the mystery of being human. And it lies encoded, as Ginther always puts it, it lies encoded in the mystery of cosmic process. So let me just again quote a passage from that marvelous Tibetan text which was translated by Ginther. In each body of every sentient being, there resides pristine cognitiveness tending toward its coming into presence. A marvelous statement, because the principle of manas is present from the beginning. This is true. It is not awakened until the descent, you remember, of the Manasaputras. So there resides pristine cognitiveness. Pristine consciousness, if you like, but cognitiveness in the sense of true knowing, the gnosis, cognitiveness to, cognition is to know with, it's the gnosis, tending toward its coming into presence. It coils itself up in its own bed, which is the continuum of being, the spontaneous there-ness of being. Marvelous translation of almost untranslatable terms. Now it's this simultaneity and spontaneous there-ness of the original all-being or be-ness which is spelled out for us in the secret doctrine. First in terms of the emanation of a cosmos, and then by reflection in the development of each focal point within the cosmos. All then, all foci then, tending toward that archetype, which, as we've stated so often, is known for our system as the heavenly man, the anthropos, if you like. And these foci have been called, of course, the countless sparks, all shot forth. And HPB, you remember, uses that very graphic phrase, shot forth, all shot forth from the one flame, and they're shot forth by an energy, therefore, you know, something is there firing this cannon of the one flame, if you like, to shoot it forth. That energy, of course, is Bohat, but they derive their powers, their energies, from that single source, the one flame. Now, our perspective, then, is now directed, or narrowed, if you prefer, to the development of our present humanity, a development which may seem, then, to comprise an enormous period of time, but which is still only a relatively small fraction of the total journey undertaken and to be undertaken still by every unit of consciousness within the totality of being or beingness itself. So this is the sweep. This is why again I refer you to the cosmic process, because we tend to think even in terms of, you know, a number of incarnations, is that comprising, even in terms of our fourth round on this chain, as comprising an enormously long period of time. But we have to set it within this much larger framework. So to aid us in understanding this, what I can only call a relatively brief act in the total drama that encompasses not only other globes in our chain, our planetary chain, as well as further rounds on that chain, but also numberless other planetary chains on which and through which consciousness develops, HPB sets forth at the very outset of this volume 2 three further propositions which are specifically applicable, she says, to our present situation. Now, whether applicable in other settings or in further acts of the cosmic drama, I don't know. HPB doesn't tell us. We can only perhaps theorize from, again, the law of correspondences, that these must be fundamental principles. But how they work out in our scheme may be different from how they work out in other schemes. That can be very true. But they must, in other words, I think, by the very law of correspondences, of analogy, be fundamental. And I think you can trace them back to certain fundamental propositions. But these, we won't do that, but these three postulates or propositions are really as startling in their implications as they are incredible in their wording. And certainly, so far as I can find, they stand in starkest contrast to the theories of biological evolution today, as they did in HPB's time. But I think in some sense we are moving closer, at least, to an understanding of them by some of the developments in contemporary science. So let's direct our attention to them. I have tried to summarize them, but I will read them in full as they are given in at the very outset of Volume 2. I think it's just indeed on page 1 of Volume 2, yes, and her preliminary notes. As regards the evolution of mankind, the secret doctrine postulates three new propositions. And so it teaches, first, the simultaneous evolution of 7 human groups on 7 different portions of our globe. Now, generally, this leads to what is known as the theory of polygenesis. It is derivable, of course, from a fundamental doctrine, which is the doctrine of the Septinate. And we could, if we had ample time, trace it back to that. But here is the first. The simultaneous evolution of 7 human groups on 7 different portions of our globe. That means the Earth. The second is the birth of the astral before the physical body, the former being a model for the latter. Now this again is a well-known principle which we've already seen in terms of cosmogenesis, the emanation from within outwards. It's an emanational process, and the fundamental doctrine of what we can call pattern, if you like. A model is always present. For anything that is going to occur, there is a model. Isn't that marvelous? You see, there is a model. Now, the term, the birth of the astral, we'll be looking at that. That is, of course, not what we today, in the later literature, have called astral, but is the etheric, if you like. And that's indicated because the former being a model for the latter. It is the linga sharira in the technical Sanskrit terms. And C, and perhaps this is the most startling of all, is the third proposition, that man in this round, and remember this is the fourth round, preceded every mammalian, the anthropoids included, in the animal kingdom. Well, that's a very startling one, and I can imagine that any biologist worth his tenure in any university would throw up his hands in horror at such a suggestion that man preceded every mammalian. But it's in this round. Now, this does not negate fundamental principles of the evolutionary cycle, and we'll look at that. You see that, for example, in the diagram that Jack had yesterday, which is excellent, that the descent into, through various what are known as the elemental kingdoms, into the mineral, and the movement on of the life wave itself through mineral, plant, animal into the human. But it is in this round, and that's what we have to investigate, that man preceded the mammalian in this round. And it leads to one of the most fascinating concepts, which in essence is the whole principle of the economy of nature, if you like to put it that way. Because it is that also, and the man archetype. Now, if the three fundamental propositions with which volume one begins seem difficult to comprehend, it may seem that these are nearly impossible to understand. So it's necessary to examine each one of them in such detail as we can, for each one of them aids in unlocking, I think, the mystery of man's place and function in the whole cosmic scheme of things. Now, this should not lead to some kind of inflatus of ourselves as individuals. What we are talking about is that appropriate, the word appropriate is appropriate, that appropriate balance between what is at any particular time in any particular system, what we may call the highest or the inmost principle, and its outermost or lowest expression. It is that appropriate balance point. For our system, that balance point is at manas. And so we frequently have reference to the definition of man as that being in the universe in whom highest spirit and lowest matter are joined together by intelligence. For our system, and throughout our system, which is rooted in, fundamentally based on, grows out of universal mind, therefore, the entire focus must be at that point, which then unites and makes conscious the whole system. And that point, in the esoteric parlance, is known as man. Not in any sexist term or any sense of making our particular place, you know, I as an individual somehow superior, but rather that archetype. And there is no other term for it in that sense. We have to use it. So taken together, these point to these three postulates point to the unique position of what we can call the human stage, the man stage in evolution, and what is more, what I feel is consequent upon it, the incredible responsibility that is ours. As heirs of our own past, progenitors of our own future, and by virtue of possessing self-consciousness, the challenge, therefore, before us is to advance the entire cosmic scheme of this manvantara. An awesome responsibility and challenge. Well, taking the first postulate then, we may understand that the esoteric teaching is simply that of a polygenetic origin. That is to say, not simply monogenetic, just Adam and Eve, if you like, two parents, but we have many parents. The polygenesis is indeed a multiplicity, or many parents, progenitors. As H.P.B. points out in Volume 2, page 249, strictly speaking, esoteric philosophy teaches a modified polygenesis. For while it assigns to humanity a oneness of origin, that, of course, to all life, there is a oneness, of course, in origin, insofar that its forefathers or creators were all divine beings, though of different classes or degrees of perfection in their hierarchy, men were nevertheless born on seven different centers of the continent of that period. Now that continent we'll come to later is known as the imperishable sacred land. So she says, though all of one common origin, yet for reasons given, their potentialities, that is, humanity's potentialities and mental capabilities, outward or physical forms, and future characteristics were very different. And this, of course, accounts, as she indicates, well, she continues in a footnote, in fact, adds a comment to this statement in a footnote on the same page, page 249 of volume 2, some superior, others inferior, to suit the karma of the various reincarnating monads, which could not be all of the same degree of purity in their last births in other worlds. This accounts for the difference of races, the inferiority of the savage, and other human varieties. Now this does not, you see, it should never be thought that it leads to racism by any means whatsoever, because what is being referred to really is always a matter of consciousness. But that there are differences we cannot overlook. And no teacher in any classroom is going to overlook the fact that some students learn more rapidly in certain areas and not in other areas. Am I right, Diana? Yes. No teacher is going to assume that every student learns at exactly the same rate, or that every individual has developed exactly the same characteristics at exactly the same time. These are indeed differences. Now, this does not mean, please, that we are consigning some to necessarily inferior positions and other to superior positions, but that there is indeed this movement within consciousness which, for our particular period, certainly, and within a time-bound structure, moves in sequence. So it's a marvelous concept. When we refer to our first object, for example, in the Theosophical Society, we note that there is a brotherhood without distinction. But that does not say without differences. We do not distinguish individuals by external characteristics, and that's what the first object is saying. We do not distinguish them and put them into categories by external characteristics, but that there are differences is very, very apparent as we look over the globe. And this, she says, is to suit the karma of the various reincarnating monads, which could not be all of the same degree of purity in their last births in other worlds. And this ties in directly also, not only with this principle, but also with the principle which we emphasized, I think it was when we discussed stanza 4 of the first volume, the concept of hierarchies. The very word, you know, which of course annoys some people perhaps, but it is present. It is a fundamental doctrine of the esoteric philosophy that there are hierarchies, and that there are, in fact, 10 classes of hierarchies, beautifully set forth, incidentally, by Barborka. Now, the full explanation of this first postulate, of course, is not really given to us. The full explanation, and we're left, as seems so often to be the case, with tantalizing mysteries which have to be solved or at least resolved by the use of our own reason and intuition. The postulate appears to be based, this matter of 7 human groups on 7 different portions, a simultaneous evolution. This is the puzzling part, perhaps. It appears to be based on Shloka 13 in this second set of stanzas. That shloka simply reads, they, the moon gods, and I'll come back to who are the moon gods, went each on his allotted land, seven of them each on his lot. Now, for this, we have to recall what I pointed out last week, that our predecessor, so far as a planetary system is concerned, was the moon chain. The graduates of that chain, if you like, those who got their degrees and graduated, are, of course, known as the lunar Petries. The word Petri simply meaning fathers, but they are sometimes called the moon gods. And you will find this often referred to. So these graduates, awakening the new chain, because there is a succession, there is certainly a continuum here, a continuum of being, as Günther put it, went each on his allotted land, seven of them each on his lot. Then HPB adds in her commentary on this, and this is page 77 of volume 2, for those who wish to look it up, the secret teachings show the divine progenitors creating men on seven portions of the globe, each on his own lot. That is, each a different race of men, externally and internally, and on different zones. This polygenistic claim is considered elsewhere. But, she says, who are they who create, and the lords of the flame who do not? We're not getting into that, but that's part of the shloka, of course, because at this point the lords of the flame, who are indeed the solar Petries, occultism divides the creators into 12 classes, of which 4 have reached liberation to the end of the great age. The 5th is ready to reach it, but still remains active on the intellectual planes, while 7 are still under direct karmic law. These last act on the man-bearing globes of our chain. So it's these 7, you see, who in a sense were graduates, but not fully graduate. In other words, they hadn't taken any postgraduate degrees and achieved liberation, if I can put it that way, you see. They may be, you know, have their bachelor degrees, so to speak. The 5th, you know, are about ready to get master's degrees, and the first 4 have their doctoral degrees. Maybe we can put it that way. Anyway, 7 are still under direct karmic law, and it is these who then simultaneously awaken the new planetary chain. Now, a further passage can be added here, which is a portion of the occult commentaries. And as you all know, I'm sure, throughout the secret doctrine, HPB occasionally has reference to and quotes from what she calls either occult commentaries or the occult catechism. The source of that we do not know. We may assume that it is part of the secret books of Q-Tay. We do not know. She doesn't say it. It may be part of the commentaries or catechism which she herself was introduced to in her Tibetan training. But a portion from these commentaries, HPB quotes, this is on page 400 of volume 2. In the first beginnings of human life, the only dry land was on the right end of the sphere, that is, the North Pole, where it, the globe, is motionless, that is to say, virtually motionless. The whole earth was one vast watery desert, and the waters were tepid. There, man was born on the 7 zones of the immortal, the indestructible of the Manvantara. There was eternal spring in darkness. But that which is darkness to the man of today was light to the man of his dawn. There the gods rested. Marvelous phrase, isn't it? Now, as I say, this is known as the imperishable sacred land. And HBB introduces us to the tradition that this continent has never been and never will be under the waters during the entire period of activity of this particular planetary chain. And there has been a lot of theorizing where this imperishable sacred land is located. I remember Fritz Kunz speaking on this on one occasion. It would have to be some portion of the globe, if you like, where in which there are no fossil remains of any of the creatures under the water at any particular period. This is hard to locate. Some place it in the middle of the Gobi Desert at the present time, but that is not likely because there have been fossil remains found there. So, however, there are various theories with regard to the geological formation, and one of the latest seems to be not only the theory of the tectonic plates moving, but now there is a new theory that bits and pieces of continents move about, so that it seems that California, for example, is made up of fragments of land that appeared, that have, you know, sort of floated about and finally jammed themselves together into the state of California. But bits and pieces from as far away as Siberia and Mongolia and heaven only knows where all have sort of come together in terms of, our state. And bits of, I think it's Alaska, have now got themselves wedged into the Hell's Canyon in Idaho. And, it's a quite a new idea, this business, that parts of continents float about and finally jam up together. It's added to the tectonic plate theory. Well, where is this imperishable sacred land? It may not be just all one chunk of land. It may therefore be fragmented, and there may be bits and pieces of it. This latest theory is spoken of, I think it's in the February or March issue of the Smithsonian Magazine that I first read about it. In any event, it's an interesting concept, and maybe, therefore, we're now standing on one of those pieces of the imperishable sacred land. I wouldn't doubt that, because Ojai is a very special place, as all of us who live here feel. And so, I think it's likely that here in the Ojai Valley is a bit of that imperishable sacred land. Well, for what it's worth, I throw that out. Well, the gods are, as will certainly be evident on our further study, the lunar Petries, or the divine progenitors. And it's they who brought into being men, and I'm putting that in quotes, not as we know the human being, but in its earliest form, which was really formless, Arupa, on seven portions of the globe. And this entire subject, of course, of our lunar ancestors or progenitors will have to be explored more in detail later. But it's necessary to note at this point that as this globe, which is often referred to in the literature as Globe D in the chain, is on the densest or most material level of the chain, and it's necessary as a consequence that vehicles are prepared for the human monads that will pursue their evolutionary cycle on this globe. This is the work of the lunar Petries. And it appears, and we'll come to that in the third, these beautifully tie together, no, in the second of the propositions. It's the work of the lunar Petries, of course, and they do it by this means, but we'll come to that in a moment. And it appears that they were of seven types or groups. Again, indicative of the fact that there is a graduated pattern, if I can put it that way, in development, so that not even of these moon gods were they all of the same stage in their evolutionary development. But all of them had reached enough of a stage, if I can put it that way, that they could bequeath to the next chain, which is our planetary chain, the models for the forms that would be built here. And even so, as Barborka points out in the Divine Plan, page 267, the first seven groups that were produced were ethereal in form and are to be regarded as presentiments of men rather than the humans we're familiar with today. At the same time that the forms were projected by these beings, there was supplied the potency enabling the forms to continue along developmental lines. And that potency, that, in other words, not only were did the lunar petries, and of course when we go into detail on this, you will find that the lunar petries could only give the models. They couldn't stimulate the monosic principle. And so the lunar petries are usually called in the tradition the Varhashad hierarchy, which means those who sit near the fire. they got a close to the mind, but they were just sitting near to it. As opposed to the Agnishvata petries, who are the solar petries, who could awaken the mind, the Manasaputras as they're known, who were really sweetened by the fire of the mind, sweetened by fire. But the Varhashads were only close to it. But they could give not only the form, but also the energy or potency to give the impulse for the further development that was to take place. And that potency is spoken of by HPB as the Dhyan Chohanic Centers of Force. And HPB deals with this at some length in the section in Volume 2, which begins on page 731. It's a section called Organic Evolution and Creative Centers. It begins on page 731 of Volume 2. Let me just quote a brief part of that section, which is on page 732, actually, where she says, "It is the many that proceed from the one, the living spiritual germs or centers of forces, each in a septenary form, which first generate and then give the primary impulse to the law of evolution and gradual slow development." Now, what I'm getting at, quite simply, in case anyone's confused at this stage, and I hope you're not, is that not only is the model for form given, but also the energy which will enable the consciousness inhabiting that form or utilizing that form to proceed on its evolutionary journey. In other words, the lunar petries not only bequeath to us a shadowy form, a model, but they gave us a kick in the pants, if you like, you see, to get us moving on this chain for the further evolutionary development to take place. Does that make it clear? Now, that very crude analogy of a kick in the pants is the Dhyan Chohanic force, you see, centers of forces, each in a septenary form, which first generate and then give the primary impulse to the law of evolution and gradual slow development. And so she adds, limiting the teaching strictly to this, our earth, it may be shown that as the ethereal forms of the first men are first projected on seven zones by seven Dhyan Chohanic centers of force, so there are centers of creative power for every root or parent species of the host of forms of vegetable and animal life. Everything is sort of, you know, given a kick the motor is started for the energy to move on this system. And so she says, this is again no special creation, nor is there any design, except in the general ground plan worked out by the universal law. Now that universal law is karma. So in a sense, it's karma that keeps kicking us in the pants, if you like. And, you know, that's what we often feel, isn't it, you see, that keeps us sort of moving in this direction. On the other hand, HPB adds, but there are certainly designers, though these are neither omnipotent nor omniscient in the absolute sense of the term. They are simply builders, and that's what the lunar petries are. They are simply builders or masons working under the impulse given them by the ever-to-be-unknown, on our plane, Master Mason, the one life and law. So you see how beautifully this is all tying together. Well, the continuing, coming back and continuing our exploration of the first postulate, that of the simultaneous evolution of seven human groups on seven different portions of our globe, we have to keep very much in mind that these seven groups are not to be regarded as seven races. These are not the seven root races, which will develop in sequence in each of the rounds. But, and Barb Orka correctly points out, that the clue lies in the word group, seven human groups, which focuses our attention on the seven groups of monads, each group being said to be under the specific influence of one of the seven sacred planets. So you can call them, in essence then, the seeds of the seven rays, if you like, each under a particular one of the seven sacred planets. And Barb Orka, in his Peopling of the Earth, has indeed a diagram illustrating this in terms of the seven sacred planets. And the, I never can find these when I want it, but anyway, it's 72, and there is another one also that is even better than that, I wish I could find. But these are the seven sacred planets which overshadow, which then create or bring about the seven types, the seven human groups. Now, why is it I never can find these diagrams at the moment that I want them? But in any event, it's in there. Somewhere. Sorry about that. But these may be then thought to, said to be the seven rays. But I think it's helpful also to see them in terms of the seven sacred planets. And they are therefore simultaneously present for our system. Must be simultaneously present, you see, because all of the evolution, all of the development is going to take place in accordance with these, along with the differences of the life wave, the differences in the entities within the life wave as it moves into this planetary chain. Well, Matty is standing, so I suppose we better pause at this. Is on page 176 in Peopling of the Earth, and indicates, as you can see, that from the moon are the seven human groups, but they are under each of the seven sacred planets. For those who may not be familiar with the seven sacred planets, the Earth is not among these, of course. And so one has to realize what are these sacred planets. thought I again had a reference immediately here, but as you may be wondering, Sun, which is really a substitute for a planet unnamed, Jupiter, Venus, Saturn, Mercury, Mars, and again the Moon substituting for another planet that is not named. These are said to be the seven sacred planets defined as such in a commentary in the Book of John. And each, then, with its own Dianchohan, its own rector or lord, and giving a particular influence. And incidentally, it is the influence of Venus, Mercury, and Mars that has often led to the confusion with regard to the planets of our planetary chain. But Virginia had a point, too.
Oh. It had to do with the seven
yes.
Progenitors.
Uh-huh.
Would that be related to the centers or the schools of the Brotherhood?
Yes, I thought that was a very interesting question. Would these seven classes of Petris, of our lunar progenitors, have to do with the various centers, it said, of the occult Brotherhood on our planet? Of which, in the Mahatma letters, there are said to be three major centers. I would not be surprised if it does have something to do with it. Indeed, each of these three centers of the Brotherhood, the Egyptian Brotherhood, which was the first group that were in contact, actually, with Colonel Alcott before the formation of the society, the Himalayan-based group of the Brotherhood, who certainly were the ones under whom HPB was tutored, and then a group about which we know virtually nothing other than a reference in one of Annie Besant's lectures that appears in her, Talks with a Class lectures, the Yucatan Brotherhood. It could well be that each of these is then responsible for certain groups of egos undergoing evolution. George, what would you think of that concept?
I hadn't thought about it in that context.
Does it seem logical in some way?
I'm just wondering if we aren't materializing things too much.
Well, we may be. Yes, we may well be.
Comment on another point about the polar continent. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I think it has shifted around quite a bit. This is why I was interested in this new theory that's being talked about of the kind of jigsaw of planets rather than one hole going under the water and others coming up and so on, but a jigsaw effect. I quite agree. And I think we also have to keep in mind that the globe, Earth, at that point was certainly far from the stable globe that we know today. And that, of course, is a major point to realize. Well, as I was saying, we then must see that, in essence, there are seven groups of monads, each group, as I say, said to be under the specific influence of one of the seven sacred planets. Barborka may be helpful indeed at this point. On page 268 of the Divine Plan, he states, "As the evolutionary trend of the races progresses, however, the seven groups or classes become more and more generalized." That is sort of spread out and sort of intermingled so that they're not clear as they may have been in the very outset. when it was a much more ethereal also situation. So he says, so that in the present fifth race, which is the fifth developmental stage, there is apparently no distinctiveness to be noted between the original seven groups. One reason for this apparent lack of distinctiveness may be noted. It is due to the developmental aspect that is being stressed in the fifth root race, namely the manas aspect of the kama principle. You remember I emphasized this last time, that we're in the fourth round, which is the emphasis on kama, and the fifth developmental stage, which is manas, but it's the manas aspect of kama. But then Barborka adds, nevertheless, the individuals or individual monads still belong to their original group types, even though they may not be distinguished by outward characteristics. Furthermore, as the racial evolutionary trend advances, the individuals belonging to the seven group types will once again display the characteristics pertaining to the original seven group types, eventually doing so in a highly evolved manner during the seventh race. So that at this point there seems to be a kind of merging of characteristics that will then become more distinct as the evolutionary progress goes forward. So you can ask, of course, what these seven human groups are or what is their origin. Now, remember that in our earlier studies, we discussed what HPB calls the three great classes of the monadic host. And this subject is outlined, of course, in Volume 1. You remember, pages 174 and 175, for those not familiar with the doctrine. And it would appear, I suggest at least, that these seven human groups that we're now talking about are all part of what are called the second class of monads. You know, second class citizens, so to speak. This, at least it seems in logic to me, because it's this second class, you remember, that HPB says are those monads that are the first to reach the human stage during the 3.5 rounds and to become men. So it would seem that it's this, in this second class, that there are seven types or seven groups. And it's a subject that we will have to give further attention to when we take up a detailed study of the shlokas that constitute this second volume. But the point here is that at the beginning of the fourth round, there is evidently the establishment of specific centers of the globe as it was then, not as it is now. Keep that in mind, as it was then. It was a sort of a very ethereal, airy sort of, you know, formation for specific human groups, so that we may assume certain external conditions as they later develop are more appropriate for one type than another. And this must also be in consonance with the karmic condition for each of the monadic hosts, you see, so that there may be a correlation, if I can put it this way, between the place where we are born, the characteristic to be developed, and the karmic situation which unites these two in a mysterious way. So it is, nothing happens then by accident in that sense. And this is certainly hinted at in Shloka 14, which follows on the one that I previously quoted, in which there is a description, you remember, of the moon gods or lunar petries going to their allotted land. Allotted in the sense that somebody up there isn't saying, now you go there, but allotted by virtue of, as HPB puts it, the karmic consequences of their particular stage reached in the moon chain. In Shloka 14, the term for these progenitors of man, and it's so interesting, remember there are, I think it's some 27 or 30 names for the lunar Petries. You know, there are about almost 50 names for the solar Petries. So you've really got to watch your step. You know, I mean, sort of like the royal babies in the British Empire, you know, are given a long string of names and then reduced to one sort of thing. So you have to take your choice of which of these multitude of names you want to take up. But here they are called the will-born lords. So in the shloka now, the seven hosts, the will-born lords, propelled by the spirit of life-giving, separate men from themselves, each on his own zone. So, the seven hosts, you see again, the seven groups of seven classes of Petries, propelled by the spirit of life-giving. Now that spirit of life-giving, of course, is no other than our good friend Fohat, remember. Propelled by that, by Fohat, separate men from themselves. Now this we get to in the second proposition. Each on his own zone. Now, what is more, the pattern that we're talking about is the same as that was given to us in the cosmogonic process. Again and again, we see this correlation. When the fiery whirlwind, as it was then called, that was Fohat. You've got a lot of names for Fohat, too. This is why you have to, in reading the secret doctrine, don't get caught up in one name or another. Look at what's being talked about, you see. Here it's the spirit of life-giving because we're talking about it. We're talking about this primary energy, if you like, Fohat, in terms of its application to bringing about human evolution. In the cosmogonic process, we're talking about Fohat in terms of bringing about the birth of a whole universe. So it's the fiery whirlwind. And this is in stanza 5, shloka 1 of the first set of stanzas. It's this fiery whirlwind which carries the pattern-filled space of the original matrix outwards, resulting in what we can call an outbursting of sparks from the one flame. And it's this same force, this dynamism of the universe, as I like to call it, which propels then the will-born lords, man's own progenitors, into outer form, effectively separating men, that is, the human of this round in physical form, from themselves. Sort of shooting it out. And HPB uses that term. They shot out their chayas. They separated it, in other words. And it's this process, of course, of separation of the outer from the inner that is indicated in this second postulate, which we have to understand. But before we leave the first postulate, there is another doctrine that we ought to bring in. And it's a very, very important doctrine. It's the concept of the shistas. Not an easy word. I put it in that form because this is, you may see that SH, but this is not the SH that's there. You'll remember in Sanskrit there are three ways of pronouncing S. And the sh sound and sh sound is different somehow. So this is a concept which is fundamental here in connection with our origin, this bringing about of seven human groups simultaneously on this globe D, in this round, that you'll remember the whole concept on different portions of our globe. Now, as I say, this concerns a very technical doctrine. We can't go into it in detail, but it is very important, and so I want to refer to it at least briefly. It refers to a very interesting concept that also ties in with this economy of nature principle, and that is that at the close of each round, there are what have been called remainders, and that's literally the translation of this word sista, remainder, who serve as seeds for the incoming groups when the globe is reawakened from a state of latency. So it's as though you don't have to start all over again. You know, it's as though, you see, it's sort of like, you know, making yogurt, you see. You have the culture, you see, and you always preserve a little part from the culture before you eat your yogurt so that you have something to go on to grow the new yogurt the next day. Isn't that right? You know, you see. And that's precisely what has happened. It's amazing, you see. So there are certain remainders who stay, who sort of seed the globe, as it were. And when the life wave moves to other globes of the chain, and I like to think of it in terms of that diagram that I gave you last week, you know, in which it's indicated that it's really clusters around this center globe so that there is not sort of separation in space, but all interlinked. But on each of these globes, there are remainders from the life wave. Now, the first reference to this doctrine occurs actually in HBB's commentary on this continent, which she calls the imperishable sacred land, and to which we've already referred. And in fact, at the very outset, page 6 of volume 2, right at the outset, she gives us this fundamental principle. She says, the reasons for this name are explained as follows. This sacred land is stated never to have shared the fate of the other continents, because it is the only one whose destiny it is to last from the beginning to the end of the Manvantara throughout each round. That's incredible, you see. But please don't think of it as, you know, a solid chunk of earth somewhere, you see. We have to be careful. It may have physicalized into solidity by this time, but it may be in different parts of the globe. We don't know. But, she says, of this sacred land, it is the cradle of the first man and the dwelling of the last divine mortal, chosen as a shistha for the future seed of humanity. So the teaching quite simply is that while the majority of hosts of beings pass from one globe to the next in the great sweep that we call a round, it appears that a minority is left behind on each globe, and this group, which we know as the Sishtas, has a special purpose to fulfill. It is simply to provide on that globe the future seeds of life for the monadic host when it returns to that sphere on subsequent rounds. It's really, actually, we're told, only the highest and most evolved type, evolved, that is, through the developmental stages on each round, that is thus preserved. And I think this is an important thing, because when we think about, you know, in some of the later literature, one gets a little bit more, shall I say, too concrete, too literal, you know, and basket loads of this, that, and the other sort of coming out of the sky and traversing space and all the rest of it. But if you can see these seeds as potencies, as creative dhyan-chohanic centers of force, then, you know, you don't need baskets to transport them. The matrix is itself filled with points, which are dimensionless then, potencies, which can give rise to a particular type of life that is to undergo its evolutionary cycle. And I think it makes much more sense, you see, than to be looking for basket loads of, you know, to get around via flying saucers and all the rest. Now, this, as I say, is part of the great economy of nature, that when the returning life wave comes to each globe in turn, it need not rebuild the form from the very beginning, but simply take up, as it were, where it left off in the previous round. And this is, again, from the moon chain. Then the movement here is a kind of seeding movement, if I can call it that. And therefore, the fundamental principle of both the form, which is given here in the second, and of the consciousness can move on from where it was. We don't have to start, you know, we don't have to make the cake from scratch. You see?
That's the economy of nature.
That's the economy of nature. It's marvelous. And so, you know, this is what, of course, as we know, the 49ers did in Alaska with sourdough. That's how they, you know, had bread. And this is, you know, this is the whole basis of sourdough, isn't it? And this is the way those prospectors for gold in Alaska were able to continue to have the yeast that was necessary for the baking of the bread, and that was the whole basis of sourdough, etc. Anyway, so it should be kept in mind, as indeed Barborka points out, and he deals with this principle very, very well on page 346 in the Divine Plan, that each of the classes of monads or kingdoms leaves its own sishtas on each one of the seven globes of a chain each time that kingdom pursues its seven evolutionary developmental stages on each sphere during each round. Now, in a sense, you can say this constitutes a kind of sacrifice. And again, it is this fundamental principle which is true throughout the system. And it's a marvelous system. And we'll see more of this later too. That each stage, if you like, each hierarchy sacrifices some part of itself for the oncoming hierarchy. And so in a sense, this constitutes a sacrifice, these sishtas, you know, to be left behind by the ongoing evolutionary stream, you see. And that's why it takes a rather highly evolved, in fact, the highest evolved type, evolved out of a particular round, is agreeable to being left behind, if I can put it that way, you see. And, but again, there are certain compensations for getting left behind, you know, so you don't have to worry about it too much. Barborka deals with these very well on page 346 in the Divine Plan. And he points out that, first of all, the sishtas are in a quasi-nirvanic condition and are not caught up in this evolutionary whirl of activities. So it's rather pleasant, maybe, to get left behind, if you can achieve that stage, you see, where, you know, having come to the final goal, as it were, of the developmental stages, you can say, well, I'm going to sit out this evolutionary whirl and just remain behind.
But would that be comparable to a bodhisattva?
No, this is not, we're not talking at all about the bodhisattvas. No, we have to be very clear on that. That's a different hierarchy. That's in the total, that hierarchy of the bodhisattvas is in the total evolutionary, but these are seeds, as it were, of life, which then, by their very nature, can provide the form necessary. It's very much like the fluid in a crystal, which is then, because inherent within that is the crystal formation.
The mother liquid.
Yes, the mother liquid, and inherent within it is the crystal formation. And so that form moves along the patterns that are already established. It makes it much easier. So, but because they are in this quasi-nirvanic condition, while the whole life wave has gone on, if you like, to another globe in the chain, consequently, they're not creating any new karma. That's rather nice to know. And third, as Barborka points out, the Sishtas are under the direct guardianship and watched over by the superior kingdoms on the ladder of life, perhaps even the Bodhisattvas, you see, which have their evolutionary cycles during the absence of the seven lower kingdoms to which the Sishtas belong. So it's sort of wheels within wheels in the evolutionary cycle, do you see? And all of this, then, is in this great principle which HPB has enunciated in connection with these seven human groups simultaneously on seven portions of the globe, so that the condition is appropriate to each particular group, you see. Marvelous correlation, marvelous correspondence, absolutely incredible. Well, any other questions now or points of comment?
Well, the reason for the Septenate Doctrine is that the number seven is the number of our nature,
of our
world.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So therefore, it determines that there has to be then.
That's right. That's right. From the one, the three fall into the four. We have the seven. This is, you remember, outlined in the stanzas of Volume 1. Actually often said to be 10, however, there's the perfect number. Three kingdoms, actually, and Barborka deals with this, three kingdoms which have moved beyond, completely beyond, our particular system, and therefore overshadow it in a sense, but completely liberated. And one finds this again and again, this decade as the perfect number. But three always then, in silence and in darkness, if you like, moving beyond. So seven is the number, it is said, for our particular system. Yes. Bill?
Is there any hard evidence that the moon is older than the earth? Because that would be indicated in this theory.
I don't know that there's actually hard evidence. In fact, there seems to be some evidence that the moon is perhaps around the same age as our Earth. Again, I myself have often wondered if what is referred to as the moon chain may not be necessarily that group of planets of which our moon, as the satellite of this Earth, is the now visible globe, although at the time HPB was writing, she seemed to indicate that. But I have myself questioned that because of the very nature of the whole evolutionary process, in which what was bequeathed was an etheric or airy vehicle. Oftentimes it's called airy, the airy body, as well as the astral body, that perhaps it was not at all densified, or perhaps it later became densified, drawn into the Earth's gravitational field as our satellite. I think we have to, you know, be very open to speculation in this area, and therefore watch, because there are certain indications that that some of the matter of the moon that has been brought back, moon rocks and so on, may not be much older than the Earth.
They brought some rocks back from the Earth, from the
moon.
I don't think they've got any clearer indication.
There isn't any absolute indication, as so far as I can read the evidence developed.
But at the time, it was said to be about 5,000 million years old, which is about the age of the Earth.
Yes, that's right. So it's about the same age. So Again, I think we have to be a little careful because perhaps what is more referred to in this is the moon as symbolic of that sacred planet, which we is not named in the traditional literature. Be interesting, you know. I think we have to, in other words, not pin things down too closely, because what we're talking about is what we can call almost made up a word, vehicalization. That's a nice word. The vehicalization of the interior principles, and the lunar petries were responsible for the vehicalization of the comic and pranic principles, which we today, that vehicle we today refer to as the etheric, or the model body, the linga sharira. And so each of the chains, as it were, within our particular system is providing the sheath for an interior principle, because as we'll see, the process is always from within outwards. This is always there, from within outwards. And the outermost is always, therefore, for any particular cycle, the densest. Although from our point of view, what is densest is, of course, this all too solid flesh, as Hamlet spoke of it.
Yeah. Isn't it possible that as we're only at the man stage and we haven't developed fully, that the planets that will rule, they obviously rule still, but will come into physical evidence later on?
I think that is also quite possible. Yes, I do think so, Janet. I think it's quite possible. They may, or of course, I think we mustn't confuse this with our own solar system either, you see. Again, when we talk about the sacred planets, we're talking about, again, what HPB would refer to as Dhyan Chohanic forces of energy, which are symbolized by these planets. We have to think of it always in terms of symbol and metaphor, too, you see. Whether they be the condensation, that may well be, it may well be, but we have to, I think we have to be careful that what we're talking about is really, in a sense, metaphorical.
I think it's rather important. I wonder if you could clarify HPB's use of the terms monad and monads in relation to the other cases.
Yes. Yes. This, I think, you see, at one point she says there is but one monad. In other words, there is but one center of life. Now, of course, monad really, as she uses it, and she says if you sort of put Leibniz and Spinoza together, you have the esoteric meaning of monad, bits and pieces of both. But technically, the monad is really a duad. It's Atma Buddhi combined. Is considered the monad. That Atma, of course, is non-differentiated, becomes a focus point of energy only in its sheath as Buddhi. And therefore, Atma Buddhi, she says again and again, the Mahatma letters, of course, say this. Now, she points very clearly, now I don't have volume one with me, to then the fact that this principle, this fundamental localization, if we can call it that, localization within the matrix, therefore moves through all of the stages of evolutionary development. Therefore, she can refer at one stage to the mineral monad. And by presuming then, and in the key to theosophy, to the vegetable monad, the plant monad, the animal monad, and the human monad, the animal monad, the human monad, and so on. But this is in terms of the great pattern of an evolutionary cycle, so that reaching the human kingdom, she says, there are Well, she says that actually, in terms of our evolution, there are three classes then, as I've pointed out, three classes of the monadic host, and sometimes she uses the term monadic host. So to differentiate then, the localization in terms of the earlier stages, we sometimes speak of it as monadic essence rather than the monad, although she does use the term mineral monad. It does get confusing at times in trying to follow HPB through. As I say, often she says there is but one monad, which in a sense then is the one flame of which there are countless sparks, the countless sparks then being the monadic hosts, if you like. And there are three classes, she points out, in Volume 1. The first class is, of course, the most advanced, which become, in a sense, the teachers of our humanity, the second class, which become our humanity, and the laggards, the third class, which it is said will not reach the human stage in this particular round, on this particular chain. But they are indeed the seeds of the next one, you see, which is marvelous, you see. We were probably the laggards of a... Yes. And I think Adam Warkop pointed that out too in his series here, that we were the laggards of a previous scheme, you see. And, you know, the last shall be first, yes, you see. So one has to be very careful on the use of this term. You're quite right, Beverly. And it's...
How do the jivas...
The jivatma, you see, jiva simply means life. Now, when this is added to plus manas, you have the jivatma, the living, that is, living in the sense that it is now possessed of consciousness.
But she talks of fiery minds.
Yes, she does. Mm-hmm. Yes, but technically she should not, I mean, she again, because it's the way she translates the stanzas, so one has to be careful, but technically these plus manas activated, and the Mahatma letters point this out, that this is what activates it, that becomes the jivatma, the living atma, the atman, that foci of energy really united with buddhi becoming its sheath. United with manas, now is able to function in the realm of manifestation.
Then the jivatma is almost the same as the ego.
In a sense, it is, yes. At that time, she uses it, in fact, for the egoic center.
Just one more question. The monad has thought of like a whole,
mm-hmm.
And then you have the word adi.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole is an adi. It's kind of like I could, for example, say the whole solar system
mm-hmm.
is an adi.
You mean an adi and anupadaka?
Yeah, sort of like that idea.
Yes. You see, yes. You can. And in that sense, then, you see, adi and anupadaka is the two highest planes. Adi meaning, of course, apparentless, the undivided, the one, the original one, I think its meaning is really the one, and anupadika is then without parent, without derivation in that sense.
Self-born.
These, it is said then, surround or make possible the emergence of Atman as a universal field in which manifestation is going to take place and becomes localized through an infinite number of points. And therefore, because a point is without dimension, every point, you see, it cannot be occupied by an infinite number of points because they are dimensionless. They become foci only when clothed in buddhi.
Metempsychosis,
yeah. And this, of course, is definitely related to the manner in which this whole evolutionary cycle takes place. metum is the same as meta and so on. Change. Now, this has to do with a change. One finds it in metanoia and so on. A change, transformation. A transformation of the interior principles, or kama manas. And it's interesting that HPB, you see, states that a fundamental principle, in fact, she says it's the pivotal doctrine of the esoteric philosophy, is that man has to achieve the goal set for this cycle throughout a long, by personal effort and merit, that is, we have to do it ourselves, throughout a long series of metempsychoses and reincarnations. Now, reincarnation we're very familiar with, which is a taking of flesh again and again, coming into existence again and again. But this does not mean that it cannot be achieved within one existence because of the principle of metempsychosis, which is the fact that we can transform the psychic principle, kama manas, within a single incarnation. We don't have to wait, you see. It's not just a series of existences, ad nauseam, ad infinitum, you know, sort of thing, of reincarnations. But this change can take place immediately. And this is the, Virginia's always often compared it to the symbol of the cross, which is a fundamental symbol, it seems to me, that at the physical level, indeed, we go along at this sort of horizontal pattern, but always there, at any point, there can be the entry of a new consciousness into it. And that new consciousness is symbolized by metempsychosis, which can take place at any time. We don't have to wait for another life. And I think it's one of the things that's very ridiculous to say, well, another life I'm going to get a better, you know, mind or a better, kama manasic psychic principle. Because you can do it right now, and what's holding you back? And that has its effect. The moment there is that vertical entry, it has its effect, and the body itself begins to change. It's purified. And I've always become fascinated with the fact that for our particular stage in which the avatar was the Christ, the cross is about there, isn't it? At earlier stages, the cross was there, you see. And this may mark, indeed, the development, you see. And perhaps we end up with, indeed, this symbol, the Egyptian symbol of the Tau.
What about the swastika?
Well, that's the whirling one. That's the whirling one. But I'm talking right now about this particular symbol. And this is the symbol of the perfect man.